From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Medicaid expansion continues to dominate much of the discussion within the North Carolina General Assembly, but State Auditor Beth Wood is focusing attention on problems within the existing Medicaid program. Advocates from across the political spectrum are endorsing the Second Chance Act. It deals with criminal expunctions. Common Core was supposed to help improve public school instruction, but recent research suggests Common Core is hurting student achievement. Craft brewers and beer distributors have reached a compromise involving state rules restricting the brewers' freedom. You'll hear highlights from state Senate debate of the measure. Speaking of craft freedom, Donna Martinez joins us now with more on that issue. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
The craft beer brewing business is growing in North Carolina, and the industry just got a boost from the General Assembly and Governor Roy Cooper. It's a boost that will give brewers more freedom over how they market and sell their beers. But despite the progress, there's still other changes that might be coming. Carolina Journal has been covering this story for months now. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He joins us now with the very latest. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna.
First of all, it's an incredible photograph that appeared at CarolinaJournal.com. It is truly bipartisan. Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat. You had Republican leaders from the General Assembly. Tell us how they managed to agree.
Well, largely, this has been an effort that's been underway for about 15 years to try to loosen some of the restrictions on distribution of beers by brewers. And what really prodded this along was a lawsuit, which we can get into later. But nonetheless, this was a longstanding effort by small brewers and family-owned businesses who wanted to grow larger and who saw their ability to do so limited by the three-tiered system of the state alcohol process, which you have producers, you have distributors, and then you have retailers. And in the case of North Carolina, there was a very hard cap placed on the brewers as to how much they could brew before they had to go to a middleman distributor to then sell their beer. And there were brewers that were growing to that cap limit, wanted to grow more, but weren't able to because of the cap limit, and we can get into some of the details of that.
Tell us about the change that has now taken place in the law so that some of those mid-level brewers have more freedom to make decisions and mm-hmm. to control what happens with their product.
Right. A cap of 25,000 barrels a year existed before this law was signed. That means you could brew 25,000 barrels of beer and distribute all of that yourself without having to go through a middleman. So you would have to actually buy the trucks, hire the sales staff, handle the warehousing, all that sort of stuff yourself. If you got to 25,001 barrels, you had to distribute every barrel, every drop of beer through a third-party middleman. And this new law, raises the cap on self-distribution from 25,000 to 50,000, and you can now brew up to 100,000 barrels of beer and distribute the first 50,000 yourself. And why is this important? Well, there are a number of brewers who say, we want total control over our product. We want to make sure that it's refrigerated properly, it's stored properly, it arrives fresh. If our customer has a problem with it, we're right there to take care of it. We don't have to wait for some middleman to come in and maybe deal with it or maybe not. And so that was the issue for them. And then also there was the issue of things like shelf space on grocery stores and things like that. When you're dealing with the distributor who may have 100 labels in his inventory, how do you know that your product is going to get good shelf space when instead, if you're dealing directly with the retailers you want to deal with, you can make sure that you get good space.
It seems to me it's really just an issue of choice. There might well be someone who says, you know what, I am so involved in, for example, brewing that I don't want to get involved in all the marketing and the sales. Heck yeah, I want to get that distributor in, have that person do it for me. But other people consider it their baby and they want to be the one to make the pitch in order to get that shelf space that you're referring to. So really, when you bottom line it, it's about freedom to choose how you want your product taken care of.
Yeah, it's an issue in entrepreneurship because if you have, for instance, a brewer, and there were three big ones involved, Red Oak in Guilford County, and then Noda and Old Mac in Mecklenburg County. And their goal was they wanted to make sure that they could sell to the places they thought they would get the most business and the best placement while controlling the quality of their product and the distribution of it. So Old Mac may not want to be in every food line, for instance, but it would be happy to be in more specialty stores. Maybe they wanted to be in Fresh Market, or maybe they wanted to be in specialized beer and wine stores. And so if they were selling through a distributor, the distributor essentially would have to offer it to anybody who wanted it. Now, the distributor may push more or less for this particular product, but the distributor loses control. I had a lengthy conversation with Bill Sherrill, who's the owner of Red Oak in Whitsitt, close to 10 years ago, and Bill talked about the fact that their particular way they make the beer, it has to be refrigerated and kept at a certain temperature throughout the process, and if it isn't, then it goes bad pretty quickly. And he was had a deal, he said, with the Greensboro Grasshoppers minor league baseball team, for instance, where they sold his beer on tap, and there was an instance that was not the fault of anybody except for the person who was actually, you know, putting a tap on a beer, on a keg of beer, where the beer got warm. And people complained. And who do you complain to? Well, you say, well, that's bad beer. You then immediately have a bad reputation for Red Oak. And he says, yeah, I don't want to deal with that. I want to make sure that I'm in control of my product. And so for these individual brewers with so much choice in the marketplace, these individual brewers really get loyalty from their customers. And so they want to make sure they have as much control over their product as possible.
Bipartisan agreement, Democratic governor, Republican legislators, and of course the brewers involved in this. But there were also the middlemen, the distributors involved in this, and they agreed to it. And this is the part that is curious to me, Rick, because wouldn't they be potentially losing business, those distributors, if people have the freedom to do it on their own?
Well, that's right. But as you pointed out earlier, an awful lot of these brewers don't want anything to do with marketing their product. They're brewers. They're not marketers. They're not salespeople. They're not HR departments. What they do, they make beer. They like to have other people sell it. And the middlemen perform a very valuable service for them at this point. But what happened was a group of brewers, including the three we mentioned, filed a lawsuit saying that the current three-tiered system was a restraint of trade, violated the North Carolina Constitution, and also that there were issues with the franchise agreements that a number of other brewers of varying sizes have said was a problem. And that is, once you sign over to go with a middleman, you would think, have the freedom to get out of that contract under reasonable circumstances. And a lot of brewers are saying, no, the circumstances were not reasonable. If we didn't like the way that our beer was being presented, we were stuck. And the buyouts for these contracts were exorbitant. They were extortionary. And so they said this was bad. They sued. And we were about to get to the point, because Judge Alan Bedore of Orange County Superior Court said this can go to trial. We were getting to the point in which people were going to be held under oath, and they may well have had to admit that there may have been some rough tactics taking place. And so to save their integrity and their business, they said, well, maybe we can go to the table with these brewers after all.
You know, Rick, it's kind of interesting that whenever you talk about the issue of alcohol, it's a touchy subject, because there are some people who say, look, I understand it's about entrepreneurship, but we don't want to encourage people to drink irresponsibly. You made an interesting point that there has been kind of a movement, at least in some small towns, that maybe they're thinking that the small town tavern is something that we should be supporting, not because it's alcohol, but because this is a small town entrepreneur.
Yeah, that's happening more and more in small towns across the state, in which the restaurant, the tavern, the brew pub is becoming the center of town, much like the town diner used to be. And it's a big change, and it's something that I think an awful lot of people are realizing, that whatever they think about alcohol in particular, that the possibility of having a local business that actually serves the community well is a good thing to have.
Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. There have been a number of stories that CJ has written on this issue. You can find them all at carolinajournal.com. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Medicaid generates plenty of headlines these days. Most of the discussion centers around whether North Carolina should expand Medicaid. We pay less attention to how well the current program works, but that's where our next guest steps in. State Auditor Beth Wood and her staff devote a lot of time to Medicaid issues, and she joins us now to discuss key findings. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, tell us a little bit about what the State Auditor's Office does in terms of looking into Medicaid.
A couple of issues or arenas that we're able to do this, we're required to look at Medicaid every year through the state's single audit. That's the audit of all federal grants from a compliance perspective. But then I have the opportunity to do discretionary audits, performance audits, looking at more in-depth performance of a program. So we've done both. We've looked at what the federal government requires us to look at as far as improper payments and eligibility determinations, but we've also done some in-depth performance audits also looking at the Medicaid program. We have a $43 billion, that's billion with a B, $43 billion operating budget every year. Medicaid makes up $14 billion of that spend.
That's a very significant chunk. What can you tell us about how well it works based on your audits?
Well, with Medicaid, the spend starts with whether or not you're determined to be eligible. So, and once you spend the money, it's hard to get it back. So making sure that everybody that the program is spending money on is truly eligible for those expenditures for that health insurance. And so we conducted an audit about a year and a half ago. We have 10 million citizens in North Carolina, 2.1 receive Medicaid. And so we performed an audit of 10 counties, the three largest, Mecklenburg, Wake, and Guilford, a middle-sized county, Rowan, and then six very small, poorer counties. And out of that 10 counties, we looked at eligibility determinations and the error rate. 9 out of 10 counties had an error rate of between 5% and 23% errors.
That sounds pretty significant.
It is, and the 23%er was our third largest spender of Medicaid. $500 million is what that county spends on Medicaid every year, and they had a 23% eligibility determination rate. Now, this was not technical errors. This was not an error that budget was incorrectly calculated, and when you calculated it correctly, the person was still eligible. This was errors that affected the eligibility. People were on the program that should not have been. People were rejected from the program. That's a much smaller number, but there were some people rejected from the program that should not have been.
That sounds like an error that should not have been committed. It wasn't just some sort of clerical thing or as you mentioned, some sort of computer coding.
Exactly. You're exactly right. A person was on the program that should not have been. 23% error rate. And just a note is that there were 9 counties out of 10 between 5% and 23%, that means we had 9%ers, 11%ers, 16%ers. So it was a range, and the numbers fell all in between. The federal government said the error rate that we should be shooting for, 3.5%.
Oh, wow. And 9 of the 10 were above that.
Were above that.
Including one well above that. For a $14 billion program, that sounds like pretty bad news.
I think it is bad news, detrimental, because the federal government, GAO, projects that Medicaid spending will increase 6% a year per year for the next 10 years. 6%. That is not sustainable. North Carolina cannot afford that. So what we have to make sure is that everybody that needs the programs on there, but nobody that doesn't.
We are chatting with State Auditor Beth Wood, and you mentioned that there is a need to make sure that those who are getting the Medicaid dollars are the ones who are supposed to be on the program. That really sets aside this whole debate about whether to expand or not expand. But if you have the program, it ought to be working the way it's supposed to.
You're exactly right. And again, for every dollar that's spent on somebody that's not eligible, then that lessens the chance of Medicaid expansion. Because again, 6% a year per year now for the next 10 years, that is money that eventually will come back to North Carolina that we have to cover 35% of the spend. For every Medicaid dollar that you spend, 65% is federal dollars. 35 cents on the dollar comes out of our state appropriations. So while the feds say if we expand Medicaid, they will pay for it, eventually down the road, the 35% will come back to North Carolina eventually. And we need to be able to be sure that we can afford that.
You mentioned that particular audit, but your office is involved in others. Are there other key findings you've been focusing on lately?
Absolutely. We have just gone from, we spend about $11 billion on health care for people that can't afford it. Right now, we are spending $3.2 billion through managed care organizations. That's for people with developmental disabilities, mental health, substance abuse. We've just signed contracts to move another $6 billion through managed care organizations. Well, we looked at the rate setting. So a person through managed care, we pay a per member per month rate. And then the managed care organization is supposed to go out and find health care for these individuals, but a per member per month rate. We just looked at the rate setting process, and we found that while the rate setting process is actuarially sound, none of the data that went into the rate setting was accurate or reliable. We are letting the MCOs in our current process, we're letting the MCOs send financial data to the actuary. Nobody is tying it back to audited financial statements. We found some of the data was as much as $4 million over what the audited financial statements say that it should have been. The encounter data, the services that we pay for and how much we pay for them, the MCOs, who benefits from the rate being set, is sending the information directly from themselves to the actuary. The member month data, how many months out of the year are you on Medicaid? Again, the data is going straight from the MCO to the actuary, and then the actuary is certifying. I have nothing to do with the accuracy of these numbers. It's all on DHHS and the MCO. Yet DHHS did nothing to verify. Now, I think this is a key point. Everything the actuary was supposed to do by his industry standards, he did them correctly. But the data that he used was unreliable, inaccurate, and had not been confirmed. Therefore, the MCOs amassed $439 million in 2 years.
Where do the fixes start?
Well, the fixes have to start back at DHHS and their contracting, because here's the deal. For every dollar we give to an MCO and they don't spend it, anything that's left over, they get to use it. It loses its identity as Medicaid money. So there's no requirement or compelling to use it for Medicaid services, they can buy an airplane. They can find a go buy a brand new building. They can pay horrendously huge salaries to their staff. They can give bonuses, which I found that one of them did. And so the monies are just not being used. And there are people sitting on wait lists for services.
That is the voice of State Auditor Beth Wood. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A compromise between North Carolina's craft brewers and beer distributors has won support from state lawmakers. Republican State Senator Bill Rabin offered details.
The Craft Beer Distribution Modernization Act is a result of craft brewers and beer wholesalers finding common ground. This bill solves a problem that's bounced around this chamber for about a dozen years. It will allow brewers to self-distribute up to 50,000 barrels a year.
Republican Senator Rick Gunn is serving his fifth term in Raleigh. He's glad to see this issue finally resolved.
Since I've got here, we've had this conversation. And I'm just glad that I can stand up here today and tell you that two fine groups, the craft freedom folks with the craft beer and the beer and wine wholesalers, have taken a contentious issue and brought it to something that will continue to allow our local craft brewers to grow and prosper. It'll continue now to allow more choices of our consumers and the 18,000 restaurants that serve the craft beer product to have that more choices. And it also does something very important. It keeps the integrity of and our strong commitment to the three-tier system here in the state of North Carolina.
The compromise generated bipartisan support. Democratic Senator Mike Woodard of Durham County explained why he liked the craft brewery bill.
I've got plenty of craft brewers in Durham, but I have them in the rural towns too, in downtown Oxford, in downtown Roxborough. Not only in Durham, but in those other communities, I've seen the positive impact these small and emerging craft breweries are having on our communities. They become places for social gathering, and they've also helped influence the economies, particularly in these small towns, with burgeoning restaurants and helping bring life to the downtowns. At the same time, more than 4,000 North Carolinians work for our beer distributors. And these are good jobs with good benefits that our distributors provide. So I'm very happy that both sides on this issue, our craft brewers and our distributors, have been working so hard for this win-win solution. And that ultimately it's the consumers and the people who work for both of these industries who can enjoy the benefits of this bill. Again, I commend the work of both our wholesalers and our brewers over the last year to find this common ground. It took a lot of work for us to get here, but we've got a great solution before us.
After winning widespread support in the state house, senators voted 38-3 to endorse the compromise. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A bipartisan group of North Carolina lawmakers is pushing something called the Second Chance Act. Democratic State Senator Floyd McKissick of Durham County explains.
The primary purpose of this act is to provide people who paid their debt to society after committing a criminal offense with a chance to return to a normal life, to obtain employment, to provide for themselves and their families, and to become contributing members of society and to really avoid recidivism. The bill is very straightforward. It establishes a process and procedure for people who have actually been convicted of criminal offenses to be able to go into court after they have paid their debt to society, after they paid restitution, they have served their time, they're no longer on probation, and to get expunctions. Expunctions are very, very helpful because it opens up the doors for employment opportunities. It opens up the doors for housing, because some apartment complexes you can't even get into if you had a criminal record. It opens up their life to a degree of normality. When it comes to the scope of the bill, if an offense was committed when a person was 16 or 17 years old, it would be covered, as well as Class H and I felonies. It does not cover motor vehicle violations. Are those type of offenses. It does not include driving while impaired type charges. The offense would have to be the type of offense that would have not required somebody to be registered as a sex offender. And, of course, any restitution that might have been ordered by the court will have to be paid. When you look at the type of people that will be impacting, it's broad and it's significant. There's also language in the bill that deals with those who committed offenses under the age of 20 that would allow a prosecutor to go back electronically and take a look at the records that might be there.
McKissick also mentioned automatic expunctions.
Automatic expunctions would be for those people who have actually had charges dismissed against them. People where charges have been not guilty. For those type of individuals, rather than having to go out and hire an attorney to get an injunction, there's a mechanism in the bill which is going to come effective July 1, 2020, where on their own initiative or initiative of the DA, those type of charges can automatically be dismissed, because when they're out there, it can be a barrier to employment. When they're out there, it can be a barrier to obtaining housing. It can be a barrier to so many things in life. That's why we're trying to do this.
Republican Senator Danny Britt of Robeson County co-sponsors the Second Chance Act.
What this bill is about, it's a jobs bill. This is a bill that opens doors and opens doors for folks who made a mistake at one point in their life. They've learned from that mistake. We've seen that recidivism rates are very low of folks who have not recommitted after the period of 7 years. And what we're doing is we're allowing these folks to be able to enter the workforce, to be able to better themselves, better their family, be able to contribute more to the overall economy. Close to $87 billion is lost to our economy due to folks who can't enter the job market. So this is absolutely a job bill. It's a bipartisan effort to get this done. The thriving economy that we've had in the state and we've had in the country has led folks to understand the need for labor and the need for quality labor and the need for folks to be able to fill some of these jobs. And this is just another step in that direction of putting folks back in the direction that they needed to be in and helping these folks who did stumble at one time in their life and are now ready to move on and contribute to society.
Mark Holden of Koch Industries explains why his organization supports the Second Chance Act.
We are really focused on barriers to opportunity. And if you want to look at the criminal justice system, it has been a major barrier to opportunity for millions and millions and millions of Americans over the past 30 to 40 years. We want a system that is obviously based on public safety, equal rights, equal justice. And then we want a redemptive system, one based on second chances. I won't go into it too much, but our criminal justice system, quite frankly, has become a failed big government program. It's a pay-to-play system. As Brian Stevenson says, the rich and guilty get a better deal than the poor and the innocent. And if you don't have resources, you're going to get run over. And oftentimes, I hate to say it, guilt and innocence can be irrelevant. And so from our perspective, we look at it from the moral perspective, the constitutional perspective, and the fiscal perspective, the criminal justice system. I just want to talk about the moral perspective, because that's the most important. We have a system where people pay their debt to society. They have to serve a prison term. They have to pay fines, whatever it might be. They do all the right things. And generally speaking, when someone pays their debt to society, in our view, you should get all your rights back. You should be welcomed back as a citizen. But we don't do that. We never forgive the debt. And that, my friend, is immoral in my book. And so why does this happen? It's because of the collateral consequences to a criminal conviction in this country. And you've heard a couple of the speakers already talk about that. It keeps you from housing, keeps you from jobs, keeps you from education loans, from occupational licensing loans. You can't get a driver's license. I mean, it's a wonder the recidivism rates aren't higher than they are, quite frankly. And the fact that they're as high as they are is completely immoral as well. So from our perspective, people should get all their rights back. It shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all situation. There may be situations where you shouldn't be in a housing situation or in a particular occupation, depending on what your crime was and where you are as a person. But this is a land of second chances. That's what America was built on. And we need to remember that.
Former Obama advisor David Plouffe is now with the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. His group also supports the Second Chance Act.
1 in 3 Americans have a criminal record. There's a recent study out, I guess not surprisingly, given that 1 in 2 Americans have a close family member who's been incarcerated. So the thing that we probably have most in common in America, our most unifying fact, is that we have all experienced criminal justice system, either ourselves or family member. And so this is not a small problem. It's affecting a majority of our country. If you look at North Carolina last year, 100,000 convictions, less than 200 people had their record expunged. Think about that. So you have to make it easy. You have to make it automatic so that people, right now, the funnel, people aren't aware. They have to hire lawyers. The courthouse may be 20 or 25 miles away. So there's all these barriers. We have to make it easy. So that people can seize this opportunity.
It might not surprise you that liberals and libertarians support the Second Chance Act. David Safavian explains why the American Conservative Union is also on board.
We will never support legislation that undermines public safety. And when we're able to slow the revolving door in and out of prison by reducing recidivism, we enhance public safety for our neighborhoods and communities. We try to hold government accountable, and not just with dollars, but we try to hold government accountable for the results they generate. Yet states like North Carolina right now have recidivism rates in excess of 50%. Only a government program can fail 50% of the time and continue moving forward. And we're involved in this because we believe in human dignity and redemption. Every person is capable of some degree of redemption. And so as we look at the system and to see how, or to see the effects of the Scarlet F when you're designated a felon, it means that you're 50% less likely to be called back for a job interview. And even if you get the job, your salary is between 10 and 40% less than a peer that might not have the Scarlet F on his resume. It seems to us that legislation like the Second Chance Act here is not just important, but it is a moral imperative. If we can't help people get back on their feet after they have paid their debts to society, it's really a commentary on our broader system and how it's failing everybody. It makes us less safe. It costs us more, and it fails to it fails to acknowledge the humanity that we all are and the capability of redemption that we all should have.
You've been listening to supporters of the Second Chance Act, legislation moving now through the North Carolina General Assembly. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It has been the source of frustration for some parents and some educators alike, and now researchers have found that in some cases, student achievement has been hurt by what's known as Common Core. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's taken a look at all of this and is joining us to explain exactly what the researchers have found and what we might do going forward. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, just a brief primer. What is Common Core?
Common Core is a set of reading and math standards that North Carolina adopted in 2010. And these standards were written by a few groups and trade associations from Washington, D.C., Achieve Incorporated. The Gates Foundation had a role to play in the development of Common Core. And most states adopted Common Core in 2010 to 2012. And it was in that period that the recession had just hit and states were looking for money and the federal government was offering some with the condition that those states adopt the Common Core. So that's why it happened so quickly after
the money train was there.
That's right. after they were introduced, North Carolina was one of the first states to adopt Common Core, and they fully implemented it in about 2012 is when they started.
Does it actually change what is taught or how things are taught?
Yeah, this is actually a pretty serious debate in research circles because standards just outline what should be taught at each grade, the content that should be taught, the goals that students should meet in each grade in reading and math. But it doesn't provide a curriculum. It doesn't show you how to teach it. It doesn't show you what lessons to provide. And it certainly doesn't necessarily give teachers a solid roadmap for how to teach the content in the standards. So they strongly influence what's taught in the classroom, but they don't necessarily dictate how it's taught. And you know, to the extent that we know the effects of Common Core once it was introduced, we can only speculate that the teachers stuck to the standards fairly closely when they were teaching the content in their classrooms.
It appears to be having quite an impact, and unfortunately, in some cases, a negative impact based on some research that has been released and a story published by the Federalist. I believe it was Joy Pullman who wrote about this. Tell us what the research is showing.
Well, the research is showing that absent of the Common Core standards, student performance on the Federal National Assessment of Educational Progress tests would have been higher had the states not adopted Common Core. So what they basically did was they looked at the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a test that's administered by the federal government every 2 years in grades 4 and 8 in reading and math. And the reason why you use that test is because we've been administering it for a long time. So we have test results for a very long time.
And these are the NAEP tests that
the
people
NAEP
hear about.
The NAEP tests. That's right.
Year. Okay.
And really, they're the gold standard of testing. They're very rigorous, and researchers seem to like to use them because they're so rigorous and because there's such little variation every 2 years in the test itself. So what the researchers, the American Institute of Research did was essentially look at what would happen if the states kept their old standards and predicted what their scores on these NAEP tests would be if they kept their old standards compared to what they were under the Common Core standards. And they found that in grades 4 and 8 in reading and math, the scores would have been higher if they just kept their old standards compared to what they did when they adopted the Common Core standards.
Fair to say that is alarming.
Yeah, absolutely it is, because what we were told, what everyone was told when the Common Core was adopted in 2010 is that it was a game changer. Not only would all the states be using the same standards, which would allow a student to easily move from school district to school district without losing content, is that they were going to raise student achievement. I mean, this was the promise that in the two areas that we care about the most, math and reading, that students were going to learn more, be able to do more, because they had these supposedly strong standards that were underlying the curriculum and the testing that the states provide. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case, and that's the most disconcerting part about this, is that we've invested a lot of time and a lot of money in standards that probably had a negative effect overall, and certainly didn't have the type of positive effect those who were urging us to that those who were urging us to adopt the standards claimed it would.
Terry, for years now, we have had a contingent of parents and some educators who have been saying this is a very bad idea. I mean, this was kind of a national movement against Common Core. And this research seems to bear out their concerns that this wasn't going to work out. So what happens now?
Well, that's a great question, and you're exactly right. If you look at polling done on Common Core, support started out fairly strong in 2010, but then both teachers and parents started to sour on the idea once they realized what was in the standards and how they were being translated into classroom practice, especially the math standards, which tended to not use the old standard way of teaching math, but introduce new methods that tended to confuse students. And so support,
and math is hard enough, I have to say, as someone who has real trouble with math.
And so the support in polling started to decline, and many states started to look at their standards. In North Carolina, we had the Academic Standards Review Commission in 2015 that was considering making sweeping changes to our standards. And in the end, there were no sweeping changes made. Now, the state, North Carolina, has subsequently made changes to its standards, specifically in grades K through 8 math and K through 12 reading. The 2018-19 school year was the first year that we had revised standards. Now, that doesn't mean that Common Core is gone in North Carolina, even though we've changed the name and tweaked it a bit. It means that we have made changes to the Common Core standards we adopted in 2010. And this is the real confusing part for a lot of people, is they don't see the name Common Core attached to their state standards, and they assume that Common Core must have been jettisoned. Well, no. States were kind of savvy in their PR and decided that Common Core as a term was something that had a negative connotation, so they changed the name, they tweaked it a bit, but still the nuts and bolts of Common Core are still in place.
All right, if we've tweaked that particular standard, then that tells me that people believe that the problem, the challenge, was with the standards themselves. Do you believe that, or is it an issue of teachers not understanding something new and how to teach it?
I tend to think that what happens in the classroom matters most. And so I think there was a combination of things, with some teachers not knowing how to really translate the standards into classroom practice. But also, some of the standards were very unclear. Some of them didn't make sense sequentially or by grade. And so teachers were, along the way, making their changes based on what they know of their students to the standards. And then that may have played a role in why we haven't seen the kind of achievement that they were expecting. But I think this is an experiment that's gone bad, and that states should seriously consider revising their standards and looking at states that have rigorous non-Common Core standards as models.
Terry, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.